Sunstone presents Spencer W. Kimball, The Administration Years, recorded live at the 1986 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 20th through the 23rd. We take you to the Salt Lake Sheraton and Towers, where the program is just now beginning.
You all here, we appreciate the support of all those who have been part of the program, those who have sat in the audience and listened and learned and asked questions and caused problems, those who made presentations and caused problems, and those who are going away with a new insight and an excitement about Sunstone and about the idea of inquiry being not only appropriate but essential to the full life that we all believe that we must live. Our invocation and blessing on the food will be offered by Todd William. After that, we'll ask the hotel service to give us our food. We will go without announcement with respect to courses, and after we're about finished, we'll then pick up the rest of our program. So enjoy your meal, and the invocation will be offered by Todd.
Dear Father in heaven, we thank thee for the blessing that we have this evening to gather together at this banquet. We thank thee for Brother Ed Kimball, who will be addressing us this evening. We ask for a blessing upon him as he speaks. We thank thee also for the presence of Sister Kimball. We thank thee for the ideas that we've been able to share, the remarkable people that we've been able to meet the last few days. We thank thee for the efforts of Albert and Peggy and the many other people of Sunstone who work there now and in the past who have put this together. Bless us, we'll be able to learn and do so in a way which is pleasing unto thee. We also thank thee for the food and ask for a blessing upon it. And these things we ask in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Let me say just a word in response to a series of inquiries and questions about who we are and what we're doing. Some of you know more than you want to, and many of you don't know as much as you would like to, and so we will respond to the latter group. Sunstone Foundation is organized with a board of trustees. Some people did not know that, and I would like to identify the members of that board of trustees and ask them to stand. Some of them are shy and will be embarrassed, but we would like you to know who they are and what their involvement is. First of all, let's see, where is Kent? Kent, where are you? Kent Frogley is a member of the board of trustees. Marty Bradley is a member. John Ashton is John's the other end of the room, is a member of the board. Dan Rector is a member. Albert Peck is a member, and I am a member, and that constitutes I am Bonner Ritchie, and that constitutes the board of trustees. Please keep your applause short. Time is of the essence. Thank you anyway. Dan Rector is the president of Sunstone Foundation and the publisher of Sunstone Magazine. That is Dan's title. He is a full-time member of the Sunstone staff. Albert Peck is the editor of Sunstone Magazine. Those are the two members of the board that are full-time staff members, and their responsibilities are divided between the president, business, publishing, and Albert with the editorial and magazine aspect. Some of you have asked where Peggy is. Peggy has resigned and gone. We appreciate the work she did. We had a fun party when she left. Spent some time with her last Sunday in New York City, and she is very lonesome for Sunstone and is very proud of what was done and hopeful that people will continue to improve the organization and the magazine. She does get an identity without having Sunstone to worry about, and I'm a little worried about her well-being because of that lack of involvement on a daily basis. But I think she will make it.
The board, the National Advisory Board, consists of about 25 gracious people who are willing to meet with us a couple of times a year. Their involvement is not administrative. It's ideas. It's suggestions. It's money. To be frank, we expect and appreciate their substantial contribution. And I would add that, in case you wonder, the subscriptions to the magazine and the contributions made to the symposium, or the fees from the symposium, do not cover our expenses. We require an additional bundle of money to the tune of $50,000, and that's what we have to raise every year. It's a lot of fun doing it, mainly because we have such marvelous people like you to respond. And if you are at all astute, you will notice an envelope on your table. And the issue is very simple, that it takes a substantial amount of money to subsidize an organization such as this. The symposium more than pays for itself. The magazine does not come close to paying for itself. And so we would encourage you to think about that, and all of those of you who have very creative ideas, whether you're on the board, the National Advisory Board, or not, we would welcome suggestions as to how to increase revenues. We should mention that we have taken on a commission basis, a full-time fundraiser, who will only take money when the funds are raised, who is helping us and has worked with us on this symposium to some degree, and will be working in the future with many of you who have been so gracious in the past, which we enormously appreciate, and others that we will contact in the future with respect to appropriate process for contribution to Sunstone. So any help in that respect is truly appreciated. And those who have worked so hard, Peggy especially in the past, have really had to struggle to keep that together. People have questioned my involvement in Sunstone, both in terms of those who say it's too conservative for me and those who say it's too liberal for me. Both are wrong. Sunstone is a process, not a position. It is a forum, not a platform. It is a mechanism for people who think thinking is of value to inquire into ideas and issues, to exchange ideas, to exchange perspectives, to take stands in an environment that is supportive because people are dignified enough to have the right to a position, not because the position is orthodox or comfortable to somebody's personal preference in terms of theology or ideology. We protect with a passion the right of people to have a forum to discuss issues of importance. We do not defend the particular position or advocate the particular position, and we want people to feel that Sunstone is not a particular interpretation of Mormon theology or social policy, but rather a place where they can be discussed openly without fear of condemnation because someone isn't appropriately orthodox or consistent with someone else's bias or assumption as to what constitutes appropriate interpretation of doctrine, policy, or interpretation of historical or current activities. They need to be discussed, and Sunstone is a place for that to be done. In the next issue of Sunstone magazine, we will have from our president and publisher and editor a statement of that policy in more crafted language and an attempt to somehow communicate to people what we are and what we're doing. And we want people to feel free to come, and I do not condemn, but I feel sorry for the quote, for the person who made the quote in USA Today yesterday with respect to Sunstone being a bunch of communists who hate the Mormon Church. The position is too uninformed to generate contempt, but it does generate concern and compassion and love for those who may disagree with us, and that may be our test of our level of commitment to not condemn, but to understand and to love those people into accepting the legitimacy of analysis as appropriate. With that, an additional announcement. We are extending our symposia. Our next one is scheduled, as you may have noted if you saw the poster in the hall, for January 30 and 31 in San Francisco. There will be a symposium. Lori Winder-Stromberg. Lori, are you here? I know she's here. Would you be willing to stand? Lori is the chair of that symposium. That is next year, not a year. Not it's 1987, and Lori is entertaining papers starting now for that symposium. It will be 2 days, and that is in addition to the symposium in Washington. And we are looking at additional symposium. Would welcome ideas or suggestions from any of you as to where those might be and when. We have two more items of business before we move on. Ron Benton has the announcement of an award that Sunstone gives annually, the D.K. Brown Award. Ron, will you come up and make that announcement at this point?
Thank you, Bonner. For the last 7 years, I believe, Sunstone has sponsored a literary contest in conjunction with the Sunstone Symposium. And for, I believe, 6 years now, this contest has been sponsored by the estate of D.K. Brown.
Can you talk louder?
Sorry, how's that? Okay, as I was saying, the contest has been sponsored by the family of D.K. Brown. And I think it only appropriate to give you a brief note on who D.K. Brown was and why he felt this contest was important. Donald Kenneth Brown, Bishop Brown, or D.K., as he was known to his friends and associates, had an intense love for literature. He was blessed with a remarkable memory, and as a child, he committed long poems to memory. Later, his literary and artistic interests helped to launch his career as a college journalist at Arizona State University in Tempe. He majored in English and Business Administration and was editor of the college paper. After college, he entered the FBI as a clerk, and 3 years later was appointed as a special agent. This was the beginning of his career in law enforcement, which lasted for 40 years and took him all over the United States. Upon his retirement in 1968, he was honored as having been an agent in charge for more years than any other person in the history of the FBI. After Bishop Brown retired, he was called to be bishop in the Jacksonville, Florida, 6th Ward. At the same time, he was also asked to serve as chief of police and then as under-sheriff of the city of Jacksonville. He remained with the police department longer than he had anticipated, always somewhat torn between the challenges he enjoyed in law enforcement and the desire he had to devote more time to church service. Just a few years before his death, he told a visiting general authority that he wanted to spend all of his time as bishop and asked if it would be wise to resign from his police responsibilities. He was advised to continue his secular and ecclesiastical activities, testifying of the truthfulness of the gospel at every opportunity. The police chapel in Jacksonville, Florida, is named in memory of D.K. Brown, and it's a fitting memorial to the fact that until his death in 1975, he did both. Now, D.K. Brown was also committed to fostering the growth of literary and artistic excellence in the Mormon community. And I think that the continued survival of this contest speaks well for that. It's worth noting that of the 6 winners this year, 4 of them were not on the list last year, and the winning story was submitted by someone who has never previously participated in this contest. Now, without further ado, let me describe how the prizes are ranked and who won this year. Prizes are given out for first place, second place, third place, and 3 stories are named for honorable mention. Now, the first prize in the contest is $500, second prize, $250, third prize, $100, and the 3 runners-up receive $50 each. Tonight, I know that several of the winners were unable to be here with us, but I believe we do have a couple in the audience. And for dramatic reasons, we're going to present them with a lifelike simulacrum of a check because we don't have them at this time. However, we promise you will be getting a check shortly. That's all been arranged. And we also commit to publish the stories in 1987 in Sunstone Magazine. Now, the winners for the 1986 D.K. Brown contest are these are the 3 runners-up. What Comfort This Sweet Sentence by Margot Chaney. Margot, are you here tonight? Yes, she is. Second runner-up is Leap of Faith by Craig Witham. Craig is home in Provo tonight taking care of a baby that was born about 3 days ago, so he has a legitimate excuse for not picking up his prize. And the other runner-up is Going Through the List by Helen Walker Jones. Helen Jones recently published in Harper's, so her talent as a short story writer is getting recognition. In third place is You, a Missionary Story by Paris Anderson. Paris, are you here? Second place is A Game of Inches by Michael Fillerup. And Michael left tonight, so he will not be able to pick up his either. First place story by another person who was unfortunately absent. And a first for this writer as a submission for the contest is When the Rains Come Down the River by Stuart Schilling. All of these stories will be appearing in 1987 in Sunstone, and we hope that you will enjoy them as much as the judges on the panel did. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ron. Next, our hardworking, good-looking, young, aggressive president has just a word. Dan?
I just have a few things to mention. First of all, I'd also like to personally thank Peggy Fletcher for all that she's done in bringing the symposium to pass in the first place many years ago, and I think that she has sent her observers here along with those from public communications, and so I think it's important that Peggy be mentioned. I also like to thank Margaret Toscano, who was in charge of our pre-symposium luncheon, which was a wonderful success, and those of you who were not there really missed a real treat. It was a delightful afternoon. I'd like to thank our volunteer coordinators, Karma Hyde and Austin Childs. These two people have coordinated over 50 volunteers who've worked at the registration table and at the doors and who have done innumerable tasks and been very willing and very cheerful, and without whom this symposium would not have been possible. So I'd like to thank them very graciously. Also, we'd like to thank those who have presented papers, who have responded to papers, who have served on panels, and who have chaired sessions at the symposium. This is a wonderful volunteer effort that's made. We generally do not compensate those who spend a lot of time researching and working to present very professional and very very good papers here at the symposium, and we want to thank those whose submissions to the symposium have made this possible also. I'd also like to thank our staff at the Sunstone Foundation. These people are Melissa Silito, Ron Bitten, Helen Wright, Albert Peck, Connie Disney, Charlotte Hamblin, and Martha Bradley. I'd like Martha please to come up if she will. Martha is our We call her Marty, is our symposium chair. And Marty is one of the most remarkable people I've ever met in my whole life. I kidded Marty yesterday that if her true talents were known, we'd have a new wave of the Mormon women depression syndrome in this church. Because people who would compare themselves with Marty would have a real hard time. Marty, in addition to working nearly full-time for several months on the symposium, has given birth to her sixth child and has also completed her Ph.D. in community history from the University of Utah. And I must say, she's also been a wonderful friend to me, and she's done a tremendous job here. Thank you very much.
And Marty is also very shy and humble. Her blush testifies to that. And Dan also, who deserves an enormous amount of thanks and appreciation for holding the organization together and for doing some very creative things and going with real gusto into making sure that, that this survives not just as a short-term but as a long-term contribution to Mormon culture. We're now going to be favored by a string quartet and plus one. We have two numbers. The first one is a Mozart quartet with Karen Perkins the flute, Jeff Anderson the violin, Kathy Anderson the viola, and Jim McConkie on the cello. Next, they will play Reverie by Debussy, a quintet with Esther Jane Ward on the violin, Jeff Anderson on the violin, Kathy Anderson on the viola, Jim McConkie on the cello, and Brent Ward on the piano. And they will proceed at this point.
One of our members in the quintet had to leave due to a family emergency, but since the hour is late, one piece seems more appropriate anyway, so we'll go forward with the Mozart.
Thank you very much. Our featured presentation this evening is Ed Kimball discussing the administrative years of the presidency of President Spencer W. Kimball. We're delighted to have Ed here, pleased that he could bring his wife, Bee, and especially honored that he brought his mother, Sister Camilla Kimball, with him tonight. We're very pleased that she could be with us. Ed is a colleague of mine, although we don't see much of each other at school. He's a neighbor of mine. We live on the same street, although we don't see much. We were talking about the neighborhood, and we don't see much there either. Ed also happens to be the bishop of my ward, and we do see each other occasionally there. And I was just commenting that I do appreciate the fact that the church does provide a community function in bringing us together when we ought to get together otherwise, but are either too busy or lazy to do so in the absence of a formal structure. Two things about Ed that I like. There may be more, but I'll just mention two. One is that Ed is terribly responsive, very responsive to people in need, to people who have genuine concerns. I've seen that demonstrated in a variety of ways. It's not easy, and he not only goes the second mile, but he does it with real commitment and compassion. Secondly, Ed is an individual who does not demand that people agree with him. He honors people who feel differently about issues. I have found that in our own relationship and as I have observed him with others. He has not just a tolerance, but a genuine appreciation for those who feel differently about things. And he always listens and is very concerned and considerate of those who do not agree. I regard that as a trait of great importance in terms of the mature leader or the genuine saint. Ed satisfies both. We're very pleased to have Ed Kimball, Professor of Law at J. Reuben Clark Law School, talk to us about the administration of President Kimball.
In 1980, several church leaders were returning from an area conference in St. Louis. They were on the airplane together. Elder Ronald Pullman got up to walk in the aisle. President Kimball caught his arm and said, "Where are you going?" "I was just stretching my legs," he said. "You don't need to do that. They're long enough already. It's little people like me who need to stretch their legs." The anecdote suggests several characteristics of Spencer Kimball. For one, he had a sense of humor. For another, he had a feeling of personal insignificance or inadequacy. For a third, he did stretch his legs. He did lengthen his stride. He tried harder than anyone else I know. There's not much in this century that can match the 12 years during which Spencer Woolley Kimball was president of the church for excitement and significance. The pace of growth was breathtaking, but many other things happened that do not revolve around numbers. 25 years from now, we'll be better able to make a judgment. But from the present vantage point, even with all the unanswered questions there are, it looks to me like we've just passed through a really important period in church history. A perennial question is whether great men make history or history makes men great. Many people regard President Kimball as an agent of change. Other people think he was simply there to ride the crest of movement that was already underway, and that things would have happened pretty much the same no matter who was sitting in his position. I think my father's own view would have straddled that fence. Many years ago, in 1951, long before there was any likelihood of his being president of the church, he said, "I'm positive that the appointments of his 12 by the Lord and the subsequent deaths, presidency of the church, no man will live long enough to become president of the church who is not the proper one to give it leadership. Each leader, in his own peculiar way, has made a great contribution to the onward march of the church. No one of the nine presidents had all the virtues, nor all the abilities, but each in his own way and time filled a special need and made his own great contribution. This I know." If I can paraphrase, he's saying that the individual who is church president does make a difference, but that he is there where and when he can make that difference because God has chosen him. The question is the same as, would there have been a restoration without Joseph Smith? It's the interplay between man's free agency and God's foreknowledge. At any rate, during those 12 years, President Kimball's personal activity falls into three periods. For the first 6 years, from 1974 through most of 1979, he was at his most vigorous. He was racing around the world at a pace that exhausted those who tried to keep up with him. He conducted 40-some area conferences, nearly 60 solemn assemblies. He saw to major changes in the church's administrative structure. He received the revelation on priesthood and a multitude of other activities. Then late in 1979, he had brain surgery that left him weak, but still pressing forward. For the next 2 years, he continued the same kind of activities as before, but at a slower pace. Then after his third operation in late 1981 came the last 4 years of relatively passive leadership, when the only vigorous member of the First Presidency was Gordon B. Hinckley. The first period opened with the surprising death of Harold B. Lee. Apparently no one had any clue that President Lee might die when he did. He was exhausted and not well, that was known, but his sudden death caught us all unprepared. After the first shock of seeing my father in that position, considering his age and his health history, I wondered if he would survive the presidency for a year. The church generally expected a brief caretaker presidency. Elder Bangerter described it this way: "We knew, of course, that he would manage somehow until the next great leader arose, but it wouldn't be easy for him. Oh, Lord, we prayed, please bless President Kimball. He needs all the help you can give him." One of his first tasks as church president was to hold a press conference. I remember being in his home the evening before that conference, how he was fretting over the occasion. I doubt that anyone ever fretted more over press conferences than he did, and it never got much easier. Arthur Haycock said to me recently, "Your father would do anything for the kingdom, even hold a press conference." He suffered from a sense of personal inadequacy to his high calling, and he had an acute awareness how delightedly a hostile reporter would pounce on any slip of the tongue to discredit the church, and he dreaded those occasions. But that first meeting with the press had no fireworks. He said he would stress home and family and training of youth, missionary service, encouragement to the Indian peoples, loyalty to country, and temple work. It all sounded very tame to me. He pointed out that for 30 years he had been involved in helping develop church programs, and he didn't see much change coming under his leadership. I guess he was just as mistaken as the rest of us. But it would be a mistake to emphasize only the changes, though that's what I'll talk about most, and not to acknowledge that the mainstream of the church, programs, philosophy, had just simply moved ahead in its orderly fashion, and we are talking, with a few exceptions, about things that are on the margin. Let me use the ideas that he listed for stress in this first press conference as a kind of framework about which to talk. First, in the area of home, family, and the training of youth, much of what he said during his presidency related to those topics, but not much of it stirred controversy because it simply restated the long-standing values that we hold in common with most of people that we deal with, of morality and fidelity and responsibility. But in addition to those generally accepted values, the church did step into the public arena with several First Presidency statements. The one relating to homosexuality in 1975 produced little response. 1976, a statement on abortion produced more stir. The church continued its vigorous opposition to abortion on demand, and the policy defined the only appropriate circumstances for abortion as serious harm to the mother or impregnation by rape or incest. Those who asserted that abortion fell within a woman's right to control her own body had harsh words to say about the church's position. But there was an even greater public clamor arising out of the 1976 statement in opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment. That statement recognized the validity of the end that many promoters of the amendment had in view, that is, fair treatment for women, but it considered the amendment an unwise shortcut that posed too high a risk of furthering the breakdown of already struggling family and of traditional moral values relating to sexuality. Then the excommunication of Sonia Johnson fanned the flames of publicity, and the furor continued unabated until sometime after June 1982, which was the end of the extended period for ratification of the amendment. Since then, things have been relatively quiet in that area. While many women have been dissatisfied with the pace of change, it's clear that during President Kimball's administration, there was an increased institutional recognition of the importance and role of women. At President Kimball's funeral, Barbara Smith was invited to speak, and she reported on his efforts. She pointed out that in 1978, the first all-church women's meeting was held. Similar meetings for young women followed in 1980. Women leaders participated more in these and in general conferences. The Statuary Park in Nauvoo, dedicated as a monument to women in 1978, reflected President Kimball's attitude. A long-standing custom of having only men pray in sacrament meeting was dropped in 1978. And while women who could stay home to nurture their children were encouraged to do so, there was a new recognition that sometimes women don't have that choice. A cry by some for ordaining women to the priesthood, however, brought no response. President Kimball's stress on home and family can also be seen tangentially in his emphasis on things like journal keeping and family history and planting and tending gardens and fixing up property. There's no question that he was true to the prediction of his first press conference that he would stress home, family, and the rearing of youth. A second matter that he said he would stress was missionary service. 3 months after President Lee's death, President Kimball presided over General Conference for the first time. A dramatic moment occurred in the meeting for regional representatives that was held before the first general session. This was his first major address as president of the church. Let me quote from Elder Bangerter's description of what happened. He's recalling it 3 years later, and he says it was the 4th of April. We were gathered that morning in the church office building, regional representatives and other church leaders, to be instructed, as we had been during the previous 7 years of such meetings. On each preceding occasion, Harold B. Lee had given us our direction, had sounded the trump of leadership. Now he was no longer there. We all felt his absence deeply. Then President Kimball spoke to us. As he proceeded with his address, however, he had not spoken very long when a new awareness seemed suddenly to fall on the congregation. We became alert to an astonishing spiritual presence. We realized we were listening to something unusual, powerful, different from any of our previous meetings. It was as if, spiritually speaking, our hair began to stand on end. Our minds were suddenly vibrant, marveling at the message that was coming to our ears. With new perceptiveness, we realized President Kimball was opening spiritual windows, beckoning us to come and gaze with him on the plans of eternity, as if he were drawing back the curtains which covered the purpose of the Almighty, inviting us to view with him the destiny of the gospel and the vision of its ministry. I doubt that any person present that day will forget the occasion. The Spirit of the Lord was upon President Kimball, and it proceeded from him to us as a tangible presence, at once moving and shocking. He unrolled in our view a glorious vision for an hour and 10 minutes. It was a message totally unlike any other in my experience. It reminded me of the occasion in August 1844 when Brigham Young spoke to the saints following the death of the prophet Joseph. When President Kimball concluded, Ezra Taft Benson arose and with a voice filled with emotion, echoing the feeling of all present, said, "President Kimball, through all the years that these meetings have been held, we have never heard such an address as you have just given. Truly there is a prophet in Israel." He's saying now in 1977, Elder Bangerter, to conclude, "Think of what President Kimball says and does. With a word, he has called forth nearly 10,000 new missionaries." The gist of that address, as some of you may remember, was a call for renewed effort, a lengthening of stride in missionary service. He envisioned that the nations where many American, Canadian youth would go to teach would develop their own missionary corps so that the Japanese, for example, would teach their own peoples in their own language already acculturated and would then provide a surplus of missionaries to move forward into countries where the gospel had not been taught. The unrolling of that vision of an expanded scope for missionary work was the thing that Elder Bangerter is responding to. But not just the message, because the message was not a new message. President Kimball had given almost that same talk the previous year when he was a member of the Council of the Twelve. But this time there was something different about the message that struck those men forcibly. President Kimball taught every young man ought to go on a mission. There may be some who can't, but they ought to go. In addition, many young women and many couples have a desire to serve a full-time mission. They will receive rich blessings for their unselfish sacrifice. That kind of teaching, strongly and often repeated, was followed by a surge in the number of missionaries from 17,000 to 30,000 within a short time. Sometimes we think President Kimball invented missionary work, but that's not true. If you look at the figures, the missionary force was already on a steep incline before he became president. But with his endorsement and strong encouragement, it took an even steeper upturn. The first half of his administration saw a really remarkable swell in the number of full-time missionaries. Then there came the change in the length of missionary service in 1982. Terms for young men were shortened to 18 months, same as young women. The change did make it possible for some young men, especially in foreign countries, who had been unable to serve a full-time mission for 2 years, to serve a full-time mission for a year and a half. There was also a loss of effectiveness among the missionaries because nobody figured out how to cut off the first 6 months of the mission instead of the last 6 months. And it's the last months, of course, which are the most productive. After nearly 3 years, the elders were again called to serve for 24 months. The numbers now are back about to the previous levels. There are approximately 30,000 missionaries in the field today. But the very success of the missionary work presented the church with one of its greatest challenges: to absorb these large numbers of new members, to acculturate them so that they felt comfortable in the life patterns of the new church, to train leaders who could influence others by persuasion, as in the 121st section of the Doctrine and Covenants, rather than by command, as leadership is so often exercised in the world. Because President Kimball had served long years on the Church Missionary Committee, no one was really surprised at his emphasizing that. But nothing really prepared me for what happened in the area of temple work. In my father's 30 years of service, he had never, so far as I recall, had a substantial assignment respecting temple work. When in his first press conference he listed temple work, I assumed he meant the kind of routine encouragement we know for members to attend the temple. But the burst of temple building that happened in his administration left me simply amazed. The Washington, D.C. temple was nearing completion when he became president. He dedicated it. That was the 16th temple that was built since the saints crossed the plains. When the 8 temples that are now in the process of construction are completed, there will be 3 times that many temples as there were at the time when he became president. Most of these recent temples are smaller, most of them only 10,000 square feet. That allows them to be built at much less cost and therefore in many more areas to be accessible to the saints around the world. His seriousness about temple work is also reflected in the substantial time that he spent personally in temple ordinance work. Temple work and missionary work are in fact very closely related. For one thing, temple work is missionary work for the dead, but for another, nothing draws more attention to the church, both positive and negative, than the building in an area of a temple or the remodeling of a temple. The opening of a temple to the public before dedication or rededication serves as the first introduction to the church for many and stimulates them to ask important questions. More than 80,000 non-members went through the Hawaiian temple before its rededication. 750,000 people went through the Washington, D.C. temple. And at least 1,900 baptisms are directly related to referral cards signed by visitors to the Washington temple. And who can guess how much wider the circle of influence may be? Let me quote from a letter from a member of the church in East Germany who describes something about the temple in Freiburg. In the summer of 1985, members of the church in East Germany distributed thousands of invitations to friends and relatives. On Saturday, June the 1st, that's just over a year ago, when the doors of the temple in Freiburg were first opened, 3,000 visitors came. As they arrived, they saw a slide presentation about temples in the adjacent chapel, and then they viewed the inside of the temple and then had an opportunity to ask questions of missionaries. Thousands came every day of the 2 weeks it was open. Visiting hours were 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. But when the gates were opened, a crowd was already waiting. Even in the rain and thunder showers, they stood, soaked, shivering, pregnant, in wheelchairs, children in arms. Waits of several hours in line were common, and one day the line was so long, some people waited 6 hours. They passed through the temple silently and reverently. The burden on the ushers and missionaries who labored day after day in shifts was incredible. Toward the end, people came earlier and earlier, so they opened the temple at 8 o'clock, and they closed when the last people had passed through at 10 or 10:30. One time the temple didn't close until 1:30 in the morning. During 16 days, some 90,000 visitors passed through the chapel and the temple. The police were helpful. They made nearby pastures available for parking. They blocked off the street in front of the temple except for local buses, but they let the temple guides through. At the major Protestant church in Freiburg, guides warned all the tourists not to go see the temple, to beware of the Mormons. That was the first some of the temple visitors heard about it, and they came over to see if the reports were true. With very few exceptions, the visitors reacted favorably, asked the missionaries questions, signed referral cards. Some foreign visitors who came from countries where the church had no presence asked for baptism before they returned home. One man asked, out of hostile curiosity, about what questions a bishop might ask the members who wished to recommend. The missionary talking to him said, "Well, the bishop will ask questions like, is your relationship with members of your family in harmony with the gospel? Do you love your children? Do you live with your wife in happiness?" At that, the man's wife began to cry, and the discussion ended. That's the end of the quotation from the letter. Suggests the numbers of people who were drawn to some understanding of the church and its programs by the building of temple in Freiburg. That quite aside, of course, for the great opportunities that it offered for the members of the church there to do the temple work for themselves and for their dead. The building of a temple in a communist country brings us back to President Kimball saying that he intended to stress loyalty to country. When we think of patriotism, we usually think of the Stars and Stripes. But as President Kimball met with heads of state or government officials around the world, he explained to them, church members have a responsibility of loyalty in the country where they live. I suppose if pushed, he would have explained there are times when, in any country, obligation to gospel principles might have to take precedence. But he made the simpler point that, by and large, Mormons are good citizens. And I think it was this relative political passivity that allowed the church to construct the temple in East Germany for the benefit of the saints that lived there. It's allowed the delicate beginnings of church activity in places like Poland and Yugoslavia and China. President Kimball held no brief for dictatorship of either right or left. He had a great commitment to the principles of freedom espoused in the United States Constitution, but he felt the church should, for now at least, subordinate political considerations to the spreading of the gospel and to the serving of members wherever they might live. The one other objective that he said he would stress is a little harder to document, that is, offering encouragement to the Indians of North and South America. During his presidency, he spoke to a number of Indian groups. Nobody could doubt from his past history his continuing concern, but it's a fact that his focus simply became broader. No longer did we see the special emphasis that he had been given as a young apostle to work with the Indian tribes of North America. His concern as president included the welfare of native peoples through North, Central, South America, and the islands of the Pacific. So one does not see such a direct stress or emphasis on that aspect of what he said in his press conference. But I would see the revelation on priesthood as a related development. It's the dealing with one minority, which the church had historically the least to do. That revelation is unquestionably the single most striking event of those 12 years. I remember exactly where I was in Massachusetts the day in 1978 when someone told me about the revelation. I remember the mixture of joy and incredulity with which I greeted it. At first, I was afraid it might be just a garbled story or a false rumor. But when we heard it confirmed on television newscast later that day, we were just bubbling with elation. There was real joy that the time had come for full inclusion of all worthy men and women in the church. And there was excitement that this important revelation should come in our time. We'd been used to quoting those leaders who said the day would eventually come, but we really had no expectation of seeing it happen. I expect the second coming may be like that. Anyway, for me personally, there was also the satisfaction that the revelation could come through Spencer Kimball. My father was not a particularly prejudiced man, as his years working with the American Indians and individuals of other races in an open and completely accepting manner should show. And I'm not aware of any personal antipathy that he ever had toward blacks. But on the other hand, I have no sense that this change was on any personal agenda of his. As he himself said, he had spent a long lifetime defending the church position that blacks were properly denied the priesthood. He also knew that change would be identified by many as capitulation to pressure, and thus evidence of the humanness of the church. But putting aside spiritual witness, I would say without the slightest doubt that President Kimball would never have made the change unless he was sure that it was the Lord's will. Whatever his personal feelings of compassion, he was simply not a man who would have acted from expediency. As he described the events, the revelation came not as a voice from heaven, but as an unshakable assurance, growing through a time of earnest prayer and pondering, often alone in the temple. In time, all objections melted away, leaving him crystal clear about God's will. And then in a temple meeting with the First Presidency and the 12, there was a shared spiritual experience that let them all know that the decision was one with divine sanction. The men who were participants in that experience received the advice to let the announcement stand on its own and not editorialize. As a consequence, they've been very cautious in what they've said, and the rest of us have only glimpses of what happened. Those people who have only one concept of revelation, that it comes by a voice or a vision, may add their skepticism to those who don't believe in revelation at all. But those who have had their own spiritual experiences of various kinds, or who rely on the absolute integrity of others who have, will understand at least in a measure what happened. I look forward to the day when we'll have more information, but that's only to satisfy my human curiosity, not to persuade me of the genuineness of the revelation. I remember one day arriving to visit my father and coming in on the tail end of a conversation he was having with my mother about the revelation. "That never happened," he said, and I caught my breath. He was unaware of my reaction, and he went on, and it soon became clear he was talking about stories of heavenly appearances and voices from heaven. "There was no voice," he said, and then I exhaled. But he also said, as earnestly as anything in my life, that though there was no voice, there was a revelation. "It is true," he said. My mother sensed an anxiety in him for some little time before the announcement was made. She heard him pray with special fervor. And when she learned of the revelation, one of her first thoughts was, "Will the people accept it?" I believe his anxiety before the announcement was not about the revelation, but about the preparedness of the people to accept it, and about the possible divisiveness of the change. But one of the things that pleased him so much was the high level of acceptance in the church. By the end of President Kimball's administration, nearly half the church had known no other president. In those circumstances, the personality of the president has a special meaning. He's the most visible individual in the church. People name their children after him. In some degree, they pattern their lives after his. So what he is and what he does has special significance. I've thought some about my father's personal characteristics. A few of them stand out for me. Above all, he cared about people. He was truly humble. He was diligent and worked hard. He was capable of enduring a great deal. He was good-natured. He was intelligent. He was open to change. He was honest. You could list 100 other characteristics, but I think they're either less significant or they come in some way under these headings. I think these are all positive characteristics. And try as I will, I can't think of any negative ones. Maybe I'm not a fair observer. Maybe I'm biased. But as I've looked and listened to what even his detractors have said, about the only thing that really comes through is people who say, because he was wrong and must have known he was wrong, therefore he was a liar. That's not to say that he was perfect, because there were occasions when he was irritable and annoyed and hasty, but the occasions I observed in my many years of association with him were so few that they're remarkable. I remember with a kind of perverse pleasure the time when I was a child and my father was milking the cow. The cow stuck her foot in the bucket, and a second time and a third time, and then he kicked her and said, "Damn you." I recall more recently hitting his head on the corner of the cabinet door and shouting, "Damn it," while my mother chuckled delightedly. It proved that at least he knew the words, even if he didn't know the music. Probably no other church in modern times has been as well known by members of the church. For 30 years, he had visited state conferences, toured missions, counseled innumerable people in trouble. But in addition, there was the publication of his life story that portrayed him as a person of struggles and insecurities that we could identify with. To know him in his weakness was not to scorn him, but to love him the more. I think the very publication of so candid a book, with his blessing, bore its own message about the kind of man we're talking about. Not everything in the book is flattering or happy or heroic, but to the great relief of the authors, there weren't any skeletons to uncover. The character of the president's wife also made a difference in his administration. Camilla Irene Kimball is one of only a few president's wives to have played an important role. Emma Hale Smith is unquestionably the most significant, but after her time, plural marriage and old age kept the wives of the presidents from the spotlight, I'd say until 1951, when Emma Ray Riggs McKay became the First Lady of the Church. For 19 years, she was identified in the public mind as the object of her courtly husband's regard, the sweet mother of their family. Jesse Evans Smith, by contrast, had an identity separate from her husband. She was widely known as a singer and as a lively, fun-loving character. But her husband's tenure only lasted 2.5 years, and she died in the middle of that term. Similarly, President Lee's wife had too little time to become well-known by the church. On the other hand, Camilla Eyring had 12 years to be identified and scrutinized. Her personal qualities of modesty and supportiveness on one side, but intelligence and endless curiosity and independent spirit on the other side, helped her serve as a role model for many women who wanted to be both faithful and supportive, but not subordinate. The dedication of her husband's biography to Camilla Eyring Kimball, equal partner, says it well. The fact that a biography of her life appeared in 1980 helped even more bring her to people's awareness. But I'd say that the fact that Spencer Kimball loved, married, and admired such a woman conveyed its own message. He once said to a group of missionaries, "I brought my wife to give you young men a mark to shoot at. Marry someone better than you are. I'd never be in the Council of the Twelve today if I had married some of the girls I've known. Sister Kimball kept me growing and never let me be satisfied with mediocrity." The second phase of President Kimball's administration began in the summer of 1979 with a frightening dizzy spell. The doctor diagnosed it as a small stroke. President Kimball said, "I have no balance." Dr. Nelson reassured him, "That'll pass." The wry response, "What won't?" Because his eyesight was fading with cataracts, in the Toronto Area Conference that summer, for the first time, President Kimball turned over his talk to someone else to read. An operation was scheduled in September to remove the cataracts, and in preparation, he stopped using the anticoagulant medicine that he had been taking ever since his open heart surgery in 1972. Then a few days later, he went to BYU to speak to a crowd of 20,000. But he had to ask President Dallin Oaks to finish reading his talk. He needed steadying as he walked. The problem was with his body, but not with his mind or sense of humor. After lunch that day, for him and family members, he said to President Oaks, "Thanks for the delightful lunch. It's a treat to be able to eat with our family without having to provide the food." The next day, he could hardly walk, hardly move, and the doctor asked him to go to the hospital for examination. When the condition was diagnosed as a subdural hematoma, which is fluid inside the skull pressing on the brain, the fact that he was already off the anticoagulants made it possible for emergency surgery to take place immediately. There was so much pressure that when a burr hole was drilled through the skull, the fluid spurted out 2 feet. The doctor thought that the president might be able to attend the October conference a few weeks later, but felt he surely wouldn't be able to participate. It says something about the man that he attended and spoke 5 times at that conference. The same month, he traveled to Jerusalem to dedicate the Orson Hyde Memorial Garden. About Thanksgiving time, though, there was a recurrence of the pressure on the brain and a second operation. But within 2 months, he had recovered enough to be able to participate fairly fully in his work, but he never again had the same vigor. Even so, a year and a half later, in April conference, he reported that since the previous October, he had traveled 50,000 miles, holding area conferences in the Orient, in the Pacific, in South America. He was 86 years old then. During the second period of his administration, these are some of the things that happened. The consolidated meeting schedule was instituted. Non-members were allowed to attend priesthood meetings. The new edition of the scriptures became available. New church museum and genealogy library was started. The First Presidency issued its statement against the deployment of the MX missile. So it was not a time when nothing was happening. But July 1981 began the third phase of his administration. He called Gordon B. Hinckley to be a third counselor in the First Presidency. Almost immediately after that, there was a sharp decline in his strength, and a brain scan showed a third subdural hematoma. This time it took more than just a burr hole. They needed to remove a substantial oval of bone from his skull, and recovery from this major operation was slow and incomplete. He never again managed to be out among the people as he would have loved to have been. And for the remaining 4 years of his life, he was cloistered. Not only was he protected from unnecessary strain, but I think the church was protected from having to pity the shell of the man they had known. He was available to his counselors. He attended most of the meetings in the temple. He attended general conference. But his last public talk was April of 1982. Press reports were factually accurate, but I think they may have conveyed an impression of more vigor than really existed. He was up and about his apartment. Somebody had to be at his elbow, though, to steady him. But he became blind and much discouraged at being able to do so little to carry out his responsibilities. He prayed for the Lord to relieve him. He asked plaintively, "Why won't he release me?" I told him repeatedly, "Dad, I'm sorry, we're not in charge of that department. The Lord must have a reason to want you to stay a bit longer." Though the sense of humor was showing through less often, there were flashes of wit still. One time a nurse asked him teasingly, "President Kimball, can you tell me when the second coming will be?" He said, "Why, are you ready?" One time my wife, Bea, reported to him, "You remember last time we were here, I was complaining that my zucchini wasn't growing right. Well, it's starting to grow now." He said, "You should have complained sooner." And one day the nurse was shaving him with an electric shaver. He was too weak to do it himself. She worked away for several minutes, back and forth, around and around. No results. Finally, he said, "Maybe it would work better if you took the cap off." By hindsight, the calling of Gordon B. Hinckley to the first presidency was a critical event. Presidents Kimball, Tanner, and Romney were all ailing, and the next year, President Tanner died. During the last 4 years, President Hinckley bore nearly the whole load of the first presidency's leadership. He was here and there conducting area conferences, dedicating temples, handling the myriad organizational questions that are the presidency's responsibility. But he never handled anything but routine matters without coming to consult with the president. Though President Kimball no longer had the strength to initiate, he still had the ability and the responsibility to approve or disapprove. No one could have been more considerate or respectful than President Hinckley. He was always careful to acknowledge that he acted by express delegation, and always having discussed matters of moment with both President Kimball and the Quorum of the Twelve. Some might think it regrettable that President Kimball lived on when he no longer could offer the active leadership that had been characteristic of him until the third operation. But for those of us who believe that the Lord has a hand in such matters, the answer simply had to be that it was not yet time for President Benson to assume the responsibility. Perhaps we also needed an example of love and humility and patience, an example of enduring, faithful to the end. In one of the meetings in the temple, when the apostles came in turn to offer greeting to the blind prophet, Marvin J. Ashton said, "President Kimball, I'm Marvin Ashton." The president took his hand, paused, finally said softly, "Marv Ashton, I love you." That was all he said. That was all he needed to say. When he had been president for 5 years, Spencer Kimball said, "I still wonder what the Lord was thinking about, making a little country boy like me president of his church, unless he knew that I didn't have any sense and would just keep on working. I'd say that no little man ever had a longer stride."
Thank you, Ed, for those insights. We all look forward to the publication of your book on your father's administration, which is close to completion, but close, you know, is relative. And we appreciate your sharing that part of it with us this evening. I would also make note of the fact that Ed has another talk on his father, on the humor of President Kimball, which will appear in a subsequent issue of BYU Studies, and commend that to you. Thanks to all of you for being here. Thanks to Ed for sharing tonight. Thanks for those who participate in the symposium. May you leave here with renewed dedication to learn and to live according to that which you learn, and to better serve and make the world a better place. Our benediction will be offered by Maureen Hirschenbach-Beecher.
Eternal Father, we have been fed in spirit and in mind over the past days. Wilt thou bless us now with the responsibility of added understanding, that we may serve thee as thou would have us do. We pray in the name of thy Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.